The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we asked whether humor is an effective tool for teaching science. We've brought together three very funny people to give us their perspectives. Science comedian Brian Mallow, researcher and blogger SciCurious, and Brian Thompson, host of the Amateur Scientist podcast. We sat them in front of a microphone and ordered them to be both amusing and thoughtful. And we'll get to the result right after this conversation with Rochelle Saunders about the upcoming Logicon convention happening right here in Edmonton. Thanks for listening. I'm here with Rochelle Saunders, one of the organizers of Edmonton's first celebration of science and critical thinking, Logicon. Welcome to the show, Rochelle.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
So tell us about Logicon.
Well, Logicon is a day-long celebration of science and critical thinking that we're putting on in partnership with the TELUS World of Science here in Edmonton.
Now, this is Edmonton's first event of this kind, correct?
That's correct.
So why did you decide to do this?
Well, one of the things we wanted to do was we wanted to have the opportunity to try and reach out a little bit to some people who are both already interested in science and to those people who maybe have some questions about science, maybe don't realize they're interested in science yet, and reach them with some critical information about critical thinking and things like vaccinations, homeopathy, pseudosciences.
So this event isn't just for nerds.
No, but we have a track especially for nerds. So it's kind of for everybody. Our slogan for Logicon really was critical thinking for everyone. So we've created three tracks. One that's an advanced kind of uber geek track. Then we have the beginner track. And we also have a kids track where we have some fun critical thinking themed kids activities.
So tell me about some of the topics then.
We have a sort of critical thinking 101 where we're going to run the gamut and talk about as many different critical thinking topics as we can and give real world examples from vaccinations to alternative medicines and power bracelets and pseudoscience and cold reading. We're going to try and cram a bunch of stuff into sort of a 20-minute talk. Then we're also going to have a healthcare worker here in Edmonton come in and talk about vaccinations. We have a great talk lined up that's going to be about the history of alchemy and how it led to the creation of the science of chemistry, which I'm really, really excited about. And of course, we have our featured speaker, Daniel Loxton, who's coming in, and we're very excited for his talk about how he started out believing in some of the things that go bump in the night and then became more of a science enthusiast and a critical thinker.
And Daniel Loxton is the author of the children's book, Evolution, How We and All Living Things Came to Be.
Which is an excellent book, by the way.
And he's also the editor and illustrator of Junior Skeptic Magazine, for anyone who's heard of that. So you also have a kids track happening.
Yes, we're still refining some of the ideas for the kids' tracks, but we want it to be as hands-on and activity-centered as possible. One of the things that the TELUS World of Science does every weekend is they do a bunch of science demos. So they have little 10, 15-minute demonstrations that they do where they make soda pop, where they create little rockets, where they use dry ice and talk about some basic science. So in between that and keeping in that spirit, we're thinking of doing some kind of fun hands-on activities. One of the things we'd like to do is with our photographer, Mark Julian Abjua, he's going to bring in some double exposure technology so that the kids can actually make their own double exposure ghost photos.
Oh, brilliant. So why do you think it's so important that non-nerds come to this?
I think science and critical thinking is really for everyone. I think it's important because there's a lot of questions we have in the world today about what's real. There's so much confusion out there, and a lot of people don't know who to trust or even how to start researching things. One of the things we want people to get comfortable with is the idea of sometimes things are wrong. You know, science isn't a one-way track that's always correct, and it's not always important to be correct the first time. It's really a process of learning. And so we want people to come by and enjoy the presentations and talk to some people about topics they're interested in or maybe some topics that they have questions in. We're trying to get as wide a range of speakers as we can to kind of cover all of those topics. One of the other things that we're really excited to bring to Logicon is a panel on critical thinking for everyone, where we're going to have the lovely Desiree Shell moderating our panel. Thank you very much, Desiree. And we're looking to get a wide range of people to kind of talk about the way critical thinking applies to everyday life, to a wide range of things, and allow them to kind of feel out their own specific specialties.
So where, when, and how much?
So where is at the TELUS World of Science in Edmonton. How much? It's actually free to come to all the Logicon presentations, but because we're holding it at the TELUS World of Science, you do have to pay general admission to get into the building that day. So adults 18 plus is $16.95. Youth 13 to 17 can get in for $13.95, and there's also some child and family rates. But you can get that information either at the TELUS World of Science that day, you can get it on our website, logicon.ca, or at the TELUS World of Science website. And when is April 9th, 2011, so it's coming up quick.
I am so looking forward to this. It's about time that Edmonton had something like this happen.
We're really excited, and we've had a lot of people register. There's actually a pre-registration that you can sign up for. We're capping it at 100, and that's because anybody who pre-registers gets free lunch. So we're kind of doing that as a little bit of a carrot to get some people who maybe are kind of on the fence about coming to be willing to sign up and come in.
Now, one thing that I know people are concerned about when they go to something like this is that they're going to feel stupid.
Oh, gosh, we really don't want anyone to feel stupid. The team behind Planning Logicon has really gone out of our way to help our speakers understand that they're speaking to everyone. They're not necessarily speaking to a room of nerds that's all going to nod and smile and agree with them and ask all the right questions. They may get some questions that seem, you know, a little basic, because it is at the TELUS World of Science. There's going to be drop-in people coming into the presentation. So we want to make sure that it's incredibly inclusive and that everybody feels comfortable in the room asking questions, having their opinion heard.
And is there anything else that people need to know?
Yeah, so we have a couple of speaker slots open. If anybody out there is in the Edmonton area or will be in the Edmonton area on April 9th, is interested in coming to Logicon and has a topic they like to speak about that's anywhere in the realm of science, critical thinking, if they have a kids' activities, please go to logicon.ca and fire us a quick email. We're absolutely looking for any more help and anybody interested in speaking. And also for anybody interested in general admission and would maybe like to try their chops at speaking but don't want to have the onus to prepare a 20-minute presentation, we're doing something called Lightning Talks, which is basically little quick 5-minute conversations where you can get up into the room, share a topic that you have an interest in or you feel you have a special insight into, and then after that we'll follow a discussion where people can ask questions, where we can bounce around the room. So the really short, sweet little presentations, more of a talk, we call them Lightning Talks, and we're absolutely interested for anybody who comes that day. You don't have to tell us beforehand if you want to give a lightning talk. You can just come by and sign up to do one that day.
So really, the tagline on Logicon, that critical thinking for everyone, it's definitely apt for this event.
Absolutely. And if you're a 15-year-old kid or a 10-year-old kid who has a topic that you want to come and talk about for a lightning talk, we are absolutely thrilled to have you. So
thanks so much for being here, Rochelle.
Thank you very much for having me, Desiree.
There's a link to Logicon on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with more after this brief message.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com. Or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Hello, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I have three guests today, all of whom make science funny, using somewhat different methods. First, we have Brian Mallow. Brian is Earth's self-proclaimed premier science comedian. He's performed for the NRC here in Canada, as well as NASA, JPL, GE, and other acronyms. He makes science videos for Time Magazine's website, is a contributor to Neil deGrasse Tyson's radio show, and he's been featured on The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson. It's his second time on Skeptically Speaking. Welcome back, Brian.
Oh, thanks for having me, Desiree. It's great to be here.
So, Mr. Mallow, how did you get into this?
I started out as a stand-up comedian, just like most stand-up comedians. And I was working comedy clubs and colleges and sometimes corporate events. And I was always science geeky. My love of science and science fiction is much older than my interest in comedy. So I was already doing it without calling it that. And just sometime several years ago, I realized that I should call it that I should just go, hey, this is what I'm doing is science comedy. And it was a branding issue. It was a the marketing department came in and said, yes, right. we need to increase profits and we're doing a poor job of branding.
Your goal then initially was to entertain, not to educate.
Exactly. You know, a comedian, I don't really have any obligation to educate. I just have to be funny. But since I've started calling myself a science comedian, that has evolved a little bit because there seems to be an expectation and an interest on my part, both. There's a spectrum between entertainment and education that I have moved more along the slider towards that.
Next up, we have Cy Curious. Cy has a PhD in physiology, a Bachelor of Arts in philosophy, a Bachelor of Science in biology, and the best pseudonym ever. She's currently a postdoctoral researcher. Her professional interests are in neurophysiology, and she's the author of the Neurotic Physiology blog. Her writing is hilariously educational, and she was on our show a short few weeks ago as a guest on the Semen Science episode. Hello again, Cy.
Hi, it's great to be back.
So, did you know that you were going to be writing so much about the odder and often naughtier side of science when you started this?
No. I started a blog because I really wanted to educate people about science. I was doing a lot of science outreach for neuroscience. And then one day, it was like Thursday night, and I'm trolling around the internet, and I found like, I think it was the coital simulator piece. And it was during the lab, and then I brought it to the bar that night, and after like a few drinks, I was like, wow, this is so, I should totally blog this.
And a star was born.
Yeah.
So is that a concerted effort at this point to communicate science accessibly, or is this just what you're interested in?
I always wanted to communicate science in a very like easy way to people who are just interested in science, not scientists, much as I love semen, and we all love semen. mostly, I'm actually really interested in psychiatry and psychiatric disorders. And so I write a lot about depression, about addiction, problems with obesity and psychiatric disorders, anxiety. And these are disorders that a very large proportion of the United States population has. And they have no idea. They're taking all of these drugs. They have no idea what they do. They're having all these symptoms. They don't know where they come from. And you deserve to know how your brain works, you know?
So this is primarily on the Fridays, the Friday weird science that you do the, you know, more genital oriented stuff.
It's sometimes genital, yeah. Then sometimes there's velvet worms. And that velvet worm looked just like Katy Perry. I don't know if you noticed, but it totally did. Nothing against Katy Perry or anything.
No, obviously. And last is first-time guest Brian Thompson. Brian is the man responsible for the completely inappropriate and very funny Amateur Scientist podcast and the comedy blog of the same name. His show has featured interviews with everyone from Mystery Science Theater 3000's Bill Corbett to physicist Dr. Michio Kaku. Welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you're interesting. You don't just talk about science on your podcast. You
No.
cover a lot of topics that people really should think more critically about.
Oh, sure. Robots, various robotic organs that they use to approximate human genitalia. Basically anything that is inappropriate. It has really nothing to do with science and really doesn't educate anybody. That's pretty much what I cover.
But it does educate, Brian. That's the thing. So, well, what are you trying to achieve?
With the show, it's just supposed to be an entertaining comedy show. You could call it satirical. And if you were going to sort of boil it down to one particular target that I go after, it's usually has something to do with unearned pomposity. Whenever someone is pompous for a reason that they did not earn, I make fun of them. And usually they're people who think that they know more than other people and are wrong about it. So generally speaking, it's going after people who think they're better than others. But then there's also a huge amount of just absurd silliness.
Do you make a conscious effort to teach critical thinking, or are you just mostly focusing on the jokes and vaguely hoping that the thinking follows?
I'm mostly focusing on the jokes because, you know, I'm just completely skeptical by nature to the point where some might call it boorish. And I figure anything that I do is going to be that by default. So I don't really worry too much about making sure that I have a certain amount of educational information in the show. I try to do as many science stories as possible just so people don't get confused about the title.
Right. But
I'm not beholden to that. I think as long as I have an entertaining show, I can't really control what people think. So, and I'm not telling people what to think. I'm just trying to put something out that I would like to listen to.
So what's working best for you then? What episodes are your most downloaded? Do you know?
Anyone that has Rebecca Watson from the Skeptic's Guide on it, those usually are the most downloaded. And then I get a lot of inappropriate emails from her stalkers. But other than that, they're usually the ones that are just really, really weird for some reason. So I like to break format a lot. There's kind of a formula to the show, which there kind of has to be if you do a show every week. But sometimes I just completely abandon it. So there was an episode where it was actually hosted by an Albanian cousin of mine, which was just me doing an accent. There was one that was co-hosted by a gentleman named Quackers, the podcasting duck, who was less a gentleman and more of a duck. He ended up dying on air in a freak blow dryer accident.
So there's no method to the madness.
There is a method, but I'm not really sure what it is yet. There's certainly a schedule.
So, other Brian,
yes.
Which videos are your most watched?
Of my stand-up clips, I'm a science comedian on YouTube and Twitter, etc. It's not necessarily representative of me, but by far the most watched video is this series of bar jokes, like a virus walks into a bar, two bacteria, an infrared photon, etc. And it really was just at the end of a 15-minute set that I did at a science festival, I did this series of jokes, and for a TV put it up, and it's by far, it's got like 400,000 views or something, and nothing else approaches it. It's nice to have anything that reaches a large audience, but then you also feel like it's not the only kind of humor I do, so I like people to see something else that's also a little more conversational. And then I've got my videos that I make for Time.com, Time Magazine's website. And some of those, because I am interested in science, that similar to something Brian was just saying, like, you know, my only motivation is to make it really interesting and hopefully kind of get a little humor in there. But some of the pieces I've done for Time are kind of straight science reporting, I'd say.
Right.
But there's one about time travel that, which is probably the funniest of my Time pieces, is also by far the most popular one.
I love that one, by the way.
Thanks. Yeah.
Sai, which of your posts are the most popular?
By far, the one that's called If Your Nose Ain't Great, Masturbate.
Right.
It's about this paper I found in Medical Hypotheses, which hypothesized that masturbation could cure nasal congestion. And it ended up having everyone commenting with their anecdotal data, hey, I did this last night and it worked great. That's great for you.
You are never closing those comments.
And I didn't see that coming at all. Like when you first said that, I was like, what could that title even mean? And I actually thought it was going to be about maybe women especially are more sensitive to smell and like knowing who's an appropriate mate for you by whether they smell right. And I thought if your nose isn't that great, you should masturbate, right?
When I smell about you, I touch myself.
Exactly.
The masturbation one spawned an entire huge number of quizzes. I had to do a survey. I had to do like data on whether it worked and if it worked for how long. The other one was whale double penetration.
Of course.
Well, that's an evergreen topic there for you.
Wait a second.
Oh, I have photographic evidence.
Is this whales double penetrating or someone double penetrating a whale?
You know, if someone double penetrated a whale, she probably wouldn't notice, honestly.
You're talking about a whale threesome here?
Scientists were out collecting, I think, population data, something like that, and they see this mating pod, and the female rolls over on her back to try and avoid getting the dudes all in there. But the dudes have 8 prehensile penises. So one comes in from the top, and the other one comes in from the side. And she's all like, oh, crap. And then there was a photo.
Okay, so some of this popularity is fairly self-explanatory. That, because really, penises are inherently funny, aren't they?
Oh, penises are hysterical. Right. They're so funny looking.
I don't know about actual views, but I know that one of my most commented on videos is a couple jokes about evolution, which similarly, it's very funny. It's just me doing stand-up. It's a couple very silly jokes. One is maybe commentary, but one is pretty silly. But the comments are people battling it out, creationists versus the right people.
See, and so is that just another opportunity for people to argue then?
I think it is. Why would you even be looking to do that argument in the comments of a YouTube clip of a comedian?
Okay, so let's talk about inherently funny topics. Because, you know, evolution actually could be almost considered inherently funny. Penises, absolutely. 8-foot penises, even more so. So are there other topics that are just always funny that you can look at from a scientific perspective and either inform people or at least make them think?
Insects are and animals and animal behavior, it seemed pretty easy because they're so cute and funny. It's not quite like sex, but
I would say
it has
anything,
potential.
Anything that squirts.
That is a fantastic guideline.
Squirt's even a funny word. There, you know, obviously certain words sound funnier, and squirt is a very funny sounding word.
Yeah, it's a great onomatopoeia. Squirt, splort, if you can use the word splort.
I've been able to wring a lot of material out of scientific papers that come out where the animal research on them sounds to the layperson like it's needlessly cruel. especially when the results of that research are things that most people would think we already know. Like recently there was a story, a new study in human obesity where they got some chimps and they set them up in cages that were basically made to feel like an average like Manhattan studio apartment. They couldn't go outside. They had to sit on a couch and watch TV or something. They had unlimited access to treats, and they just sat there for their entire lives, just eating.
Did they have a roach problem?
They did not have a roach problem. No, that was controlled.
Did they introduce a bed bug condition?
They would make them go to some hotels, and they would come back with bed bugs, you know. So, like, the whole point of it was to see what would happen if these animals got very depressed and fat. And turns out eating too much is apparently unhealthy. So, yeah, and then there was another study about depression in mice where they wanted to study like what happens right when you're on the verge of just giving up and just not caring about your life anymore. So they put mice in buckets of water and made them swim in circles with no exit and just waited until the moment when they just decided, I'm just going to stop swimming because there's no point.
Actually, that's really common. That's one of the most common tests for antidepressant efficacy. It's called the forced swim test. And it actually only lasts about 6 minutes per mouse.
So I like talking about that because you do learn, you know, what goes into testing these. Usually it is testing some sort of drug. And, you know, there is some sort of effect that we get out of it. And there is something that we learn about it. But I like the idea that when people are learning about the science thing, they also have in the back of their mind something horrible that had to happen for it to take place.
Right. Okay. So we have innately funny topics, which are genital oriented and animal cruelty. Good enough. Okay. So
and now, if they're cruel to an animal's genitals, it's even better.
Right.
I think we've actually found the magic button for comedy right there.
So I saw a thing on how to give a vasectomy to an elephant.
Oh. Was that on eHow.com?
I think it might have been on Ask, actually.
Yahoo Answers.
So what's more difficult then? Are there specific topics that it's hard to make jokes about?
I've been feeling like I needed some material on the environment and on global warming and climate change. And I'm not sure if I'm convinced that it's an impossible topic, but the stuff hasn't been flowing exactly. Some topics, when you think about them, it's hard to get around. You got to get around that tragic part to get to a different perspective where you see it as funny.
Yeah, there's a certain number of topics that just, like, I guess cancer can lend itself to a really macabre kind of humor.
I mean,
you know, you don't really want to be like, all right, so this metastatic tumor walks into a bar.
Same would go for, obviously, AIDS has always been. And and in comedy, we kind of, like, there's certain subjects that it's not impossible. And it's very easy to do humor in a really tasteless way that's offensive and cheap and not really respectably funny. But I wouldn't say any subject is impossible to do good humor on.
For example, psychiatric disorders are not generally funny.
Right.
Ever?
Because it's the most easy way to go about it is to sit around and, you know, make fun of what you might call crazy people, but they're not. And so you can't approach it. It's hard to approach something with humor and respect.
Right.
Yes.
When it's something that's a difficult topic.
If you go through all those websites that do like news of the weird and things like that, you find these stories about people doing things that are very funny on the surface. But then when you really think about it, these people are just average people with horrible problems.
Yes.
And you run into a problem of who your joke's target is at that point. So I've dealt with it alternately by just not talking about those things. And sometimes I'll talk about them, but then I won't mention the person's name, or the joke is never about, you know, this person is crazy. I have to try to find a way to make the joke about, you know, something else. This week there was a story sort of like that, where there was a guy who got arrested for child endangerment because the cops picked him up at like 1:30 in the morning, dressed like a ninja, doing ninja moves around his neighborhood. I wanted to talk about that, but I didn't want to just make fun of the guy, because what if he's got some horrible problem? So the sort of crux of the joke.
Or what if he's a ninja?
That's what the joke was about.
If he's an actual ninja, he's going to come up and knife you, and you won't even know. You could be dead right now.
Right. And so the bit was about how sometimes there are certain professions where it's okay to endanger your children by abandoning them. And one of those is if you're a ninja, because you have important jobs to do. And then the Japan thing, that was tricky too, because I've gotten a lot of humor over the years out of talking about some of the weirder sexual fetishes that come out of Japan. And so just in mentioning Japan, I sort of made a half apology about all the things I've said about the Japanese culture over the years, and did a bit about all of the weird sexual fetishes that you find in other countries.
Oh, that's nice.
Somebody actually sent me a joke about Japan right after the earthquake, and you would have thought, okay, you know, this is not a subject ripe for comedy right now, but the subject let me know that there was going to be a joke in Japan, and I was like very skeptical. But the joke is, I'm really impressed with Japan. After an earthquake and a tsunami, the only things to lose their cool have been a couple of reactors. It's not a hysterical joke, but it's also not an offensive joke, really. Because it has this little bit of a compliment. The only things to lose their cool have been a couple of reactors. Maybe it would have to be more offensive if it wanted to be funnier.
When I'm trying to kind of lighten the mood, when I'm blogging about things that are really kind of very serious, like suicide, depression, things like that, I mean, I tend to make things that are humorous, not about the science.
Right.
Like, yes.
Say funny things that aren't about that. So you can lighten the mood with humor based on other topics, usually on how much I can't spell and whether or not I'm drunk right now. That happens too.
Always a go-to topic, really.
That is the thing. That's that if you can be funny and be telling a science story, there are ways to be funny where it doesn't have to necessarily come out of the complex science subject that you're trying to express, but there's stuff just to the side of it that are in your humorous telling of it. There is some connection I've always thought between Newton's laws of motion, and for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And the setup of a joke is like the action, and the punchline is like the reaction, like it's fundamental physics.
Nicely done, sir. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and today we're talking about making science funny. I'm here with Brian Thompson of the Amateur Scientist podcast, Cy Curious of the blog Neurotic Physiology, and Brian Mallow, science comedian. Now, I have a bunch of questions here already. This is from Greg Fish.
Do you foresee a resurgence of sex robot jokes in the near future with new humanoid robots being made in Japan? Or is that niche pretty much tapped out?
No, because the humanoid robots made in Japan are no longer being manufactured due to the horrible tragedy, and the person who wrote that question should feel really bad about bringing that up.
Really?
Yeah, way to go.
Just brought everybody down.
Mr. Fish.
Now, I should add that I just made that up. So,
yeah, I felt bad for a second.
There's
probably more jokes in this area, right? This is the beginning of robotics and AI. We're just at the very beginnings of something.
Oh, I was just thinking with robotic sex toys, you'd have less of a refractory period, so the humor could just come again and again and again.
And what was that first thing in part of your introduction of Brian? What was that about robotics and genitalia?
That's pretty much his whole show.
Okay, sorry. Because you know what I've always thought it was very humorous that on a lot of condom packages, they would say this condom has been electronically tested. And to me, whenever I've read that, I've thought electronically tested. You mean by robots? By effing robots? I don't think I want my condom tested, you know, pre-tested by effing robots.
Actually, what tests them is this giant glass dildo that they stretch it over to make sure it's good enough.
It's good enough for a glass dildo, it's good enough for me.
Pretty much.
Let's go to another question. Now, this question is from Struby in the chat.
Is it possible to do science humor without reference to people or giving human qualities to non-humans?
Yeah, I mean, for one thing, like, I do a lot of playing with language and wordplay and analogy, like colorful use of, so not anthropomorphizing, but in a way, I think anthropomorphizing is analogous to the use of analogies and metaphors,
Interesting.
If that made any sense.
Right,
analogies, so I put something analogous in your analogy.
Right, but using analogies and using metaphors and playful stuff and...
That's very foreign to me because that's what I try to look for in everything that I do. It's to look for the human factor because that's what I find the most interesting. Kurt Vonnegut, I think, said, I'm going to paraphrase Kurt Vonnegut because I'm a stereotype of a late 20s liberal. I think he said that no landscape is going to be as interesting as the same landscape with a person in it. That's how I do my show and everything else. It's just straight technical information. Just doesn't work for me. I have to find somebody to give a sort of human element to every story.
We have another question from the chat room.
What's higher on the comedy scale? A monkey pretending to be a human or a creationist Ken Ham pretending to be a human? And that's from Brad LeClaire.
You know, this actually, I'm not going to answer that question, but... But that brings up something that's a good point. We were talking about stuff that, you know, is hard to make jokes about. And I find that creationism is really difficult for me personally, not because it's offensive or, you know, you're trying to walk a tightrope or anything like that, but just because it's so boring. You know, you can Google on the internet and you'll find a million different websites from people talking about their evidence for creationism. And obviously they're wrong. But after a while, it's just like, we all know, I mean, everybody who listens to my show, I'm assuming, knows that creationism is factually incorrect. So if you're going to start making fun of it, eventually it just gets to the point where it's no longer satire, it's just ridicule. And the relationship between satire and ridicule is sort of like the relationship between a square and a rectangle. You know, satire is a form of ridicule, but it's not just simple ridicule. It's illustrating a point about something. It's illustrating absurdity in some way. So, you know, when you just... talk about, you know, creationists and how they're wrong all the time, it just kind of gets very dull. You know, there are two different kinds of laughs. There are real laughs and then there are laughs of agreement. I kind of want to go after real laughs and not like applause laughs because they agree with what I'm saying. I want people that are listening to my show to find it funny and not something that they already knew.
Well, maybe actually let's break this down a bit then. So there are the innately funny topics in one category, and in another there are kind of the in-jokes about math and particle physics and such that are funny to a scientifically literate audience. And then there's snark. Brian, you do often use snark. So when is it effective then?
I don't know. It's difficult to say because I don't think in terms of being effective. I just think in terms of what I find funny. And so I can look at the things that I find funny and sort of drill that down into commonalities between all the things I find funny. And, you know, like I mentioned before, target is key. The target of the joke has to be the person in power. It can't be somebody who's helpless. Otherwise, you look like a bully. So, you know, there's overlap. If you're the underdog and your snark is directed at someone who is more powerful than you, then it's just going to be inherently more funny than if you're just picking on someone who is just some random Pentecostal in Tennessee who has a blogger account and posted pictures of her family and then her list of three things she's heard about how creationism is true. But, you know, if she's blogging about all of her different denim skirts, then, you know, I might say something.
And we have a question from Daniel Loxton in Victoria, BC.
Legendary Scientific American columnist Martin Gardner famously said, "When writing about extreme eccentricities of science, I have adopted H.L. Mencken's sage advice, 'One horse laugh is worth 10,000 syllogisms.' Assuming this is at least sometimes true, are there, or should there be, ethical, pedagogical, or artistic limits on the use of ridicule in science communication?"
How about you, Cy?
Well, I think you lost me around about pedagogical. I was like, whoa.
Yeah, that was a tough one, huh?
Long words. Do not use long words. I mean, I think there's issues. For example, I find there's a very big difference between using snark and ridicule in a video or a podcast and using snark and ridicule in type, like in a blog. And I wish I could carry this big card around that just says, there is no tone of voice on the internet. Okay? If you've typed it, the person who's reading it does not have the same tone of voice you do. And so if you're going to be snarky in a blog post, for example, it needs to be really, really fracking obvious, like dripping off the page. And even then, sometimes people will accidentally take you seriously.
You know, I don't tend to be that snarky and I don't tend to ridicule much. I'm not, if I'm going to perform for a science organization and I've had this reaction, well, you're not going to make fun of us or make fun of science or scientists. And I really don't, but that's what you expect scientists to do. But I have a blog post about one of those cases where a guy in Florida said there's an image of Jesus in his x-ray. And I made what I thought was a very obviously very sarcastic long blog post about what I saw in the x-ray. I couldn't even see what they think is Jesus, but I saw something that kind of looked like a gray, an extraterrestrial. And that really makes more sense and fits the canon, a gray. Because why would Jesus – nobody – where did it ever say that Jesus would return inside somebody's rib cage? But an alien.
Aliens busting out, yeah.
Right. An alien, some kind of metamorphosizing alien that spends part of its time ingested inside a human body. That totally made sense. Well, now – thanks to that blog post, Jesus is one of the search terms that brings the most people to my website.
Oh.
And people, even just yesterday, some girl left a – I want to say it's a girl. These people saying, I see Jesus there, and it makes them feel better. And this is reading this the horrible, mocking blog post that I've made. And then they follow it with stuff about how maybe the guy was praying. And not only did Jesus answer his prayers, but got caught in the x-ray at the same time. What do you do with that?
No matter what you type, someone will read it through their own prism, and you can't, you know, it's never obvious that you're kidding unless you even add the phrase at the end, I'm kidding. And even then people don't believe you.
Yeah, tone and voice is extremely important in comedy. Well, Brian has experience in stand-up, and so you might already know that there are certain rules in stand-up for like what you can wear on stage. Like, with certain exceptions, a stand-up comedian is not going to be wearing, like, a super cool leather jacket. Because in comedy, you don't want to look like you think you're better than the audience.
I've heard both sides of it, too, though. You don't want to be dressed too much better than the audience. But the other side of that is, like, it's a show and you're supposed to be on stage.
Well, you can wear a suit. You know, you can wear a nice suit. Yeah. Because, you know, unless it's something, like, outrageous – even if you're in a suit, even though you're more formal than the audience, you're still sort of invisible because that's the standard human adult male uniform is the suit.
You have to leave the opera dress at home is what you're saying. Yeah.
Well, I can wear the opera dress.
Okay.
Does that still follow then that you shouldn't be smarter than your audience?
No, you can't really do that because then once you start sort of modulating what you think is going to go over people's heads, then you just become condescending. So, you know, the best thing you can do is just be true to your voice. There are a lot of things that go into tone. You know, for instance, if you watch The Daily Show, it's not just Jon Stewart talking as Jon Stewart into a camera about every news story. There are characters on the show played by the correspondents. And oftentimes when they're talking about a story, the correspondent will assume a sort of ironic tone that's agreeing with the thing that they're satirizing.
Right.
And the reason that they do that, once you have that ironic tone, then you've distanced yourself yourself from the subject, and it takes a lot of the smugness out of it. Because that's the problem with just sort of speaking straight about, oh, this is dumb, and here's why it's dumb, is because then you sort of seem like you think that you know everything. You seem like an obnoxious know-it-all. So you can have snark without smugness, and there are a lot of things you can do to sort of modulate the smugness. I do that a lot in my podcast, is having this ironic, this mock ironic tone, and I do a lot of making fun of myself, because the best thing you can do in comedy is make yourself look like a moron.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking. My guests today are Cy Curious of the blog Neurotic Physiology, Brian Mallow, science comedian, and the gentleman behind the science videos on Time Magazine's website, and also Brian Thompson of the Amateur Scientist podcast. And we'll be right back with more Making Science Funny after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we examine the ways that society and science inform and influence each other. We're joined by Marie-Claire Shanahan, professor of science education at the University of Alberta, to discuss how science fits into the broader framework of our common culture. And we'll talk to science writer Mike McRae, author of the new book Tribal Science, that looks at how brains that evolve to maintain social connections can manage to make objective observations. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking on your local radio station or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm on the line with neurotic physiology blogger Cy Curious, Brian Thompson of the Amateur Scientist podcast, and Brian Mallow, science comedian and contributor to Neil deGrasse Tyson's radio show. We've been discussing how to make science funny. So we have a question from the audience. This is Norm Gold.
Successful communication begins by engaging the listener from the very beginning. How do you get your readers or audience members interested enough in an arcane topic to pay attention to the end and enjoy the humor?
I was wondering if we were going to talk about the use of humor in educating or communicating. Like, is there even any evidence for such a thing? And I think that I've intuitively always done that. I've done little essays for radio before, and it's always been my tendency to start with a joke that somehow relates to the topic and then segue into the topic. And hopefully, and part of the topic I might discuss seriously, but ideally I'd make it sort of humorous, maybe not as humorous as the outright joke that I began with, but hopefully colorfully described, and then come back around. Hopefully, you know, you keep their interest, and then at the end, something that kind of calls back something from the beginning or another little bit of humor at the end. I think there is some evidence that humor is good for retention, that kind of engagement and the positive emotion associated with humor increases attention and retention.
Even when you have a topic that's not necessarily funny, the humor as well as other methods can be used to make the audience identify with you. And so if you start with like humor that makes fun of yourself, the audience will maybe identify with you more. Or I often use like an intro that kind of like, oh, hey, I have this problem. My bra is too tight. Maybe I'm constipated. I wrote that once. Anyway, my bra is not too tight. But things like that where you identify with the audience, hey, I'm like you. I'm curious about this. And then you tell them and then you say, hey, now you know. No one's half the battle, you know?
What do you think, Thompson?
It's been a while since I've written things that are primarily meant to educate, but like Brian said, if you start out with a joke, you kind of have everybody's attention. So I used to write this essay series for this website called Pink Ray Gun, which is a website for girls who are into sci-fi. I wrote for it because I am a 14-year-old girl, and I wrote this column called Ask an Amateur Scientist, and each column was about a different sort of monster or mystery, or you know, the kind of thing you'd find in like 101 weird stories type books. And I would start every one with a paragraph or two that may not even really directly relate to the topic at hand, but was just some funny story. And that was kind of the formula that I used for it. Because I mean, once you have people hooked, even if the thing that you're talking about later on doesn't necessarily have anything directly to do with what you hooked them with, they're already there and they're going to be with you and they trust you. And a big part of it is just justifying your asking people to spend their time listening or reading to whatever it is you're doing, because that's really what you're fighting for, is people's time. And it's very valuable. And if you make them think that you're giving them something in return for it, then they'll be inherently grateful. Unless they're just horrible people, and then you don't want them reading your stuff.
And you know, something that both, so Psycurious and Brian both touched on this, that idea of like self-deprecating humor, making fun of yourself. It's useful because there are theories of humor. I don't know how much we really know about it, but one thing certainly is that it makes us feel better when we laugh at somebody else. And if I'm not going to do the humor that's ripping into other people, then it's got to be self-deprecating for that particular effect, that if I make myself look like an idiot, then the audience can feel better about themselves. We feel better about ourselves when we see somebody else slip on the banana peel, as long as it's one of those pompous people that deserves it.
I bet you someone yeah, has written a dissertation on the science of Schadenfreude.
Oh, I'm certain that this is a subject that it really has been written about. Not very many comedians have really studied this, and I've only started looking into it relatively recently, but there is a lot out there. There's even an international journal of humor research, I think.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and today we're talking about science and comedy with Brian Thompson of the Amateur Scientist Podcast, Psycurious of the blog Neurotic Physiology, and Brian Mallow, science comedian. So who do you guys find funny? Who do you think does science or critical thinking comedy well?
I think science comedian. I mean, he's hysterical, man. I like fall over.
I should have said no saying anyone else on the panel.
I'm laughing right now. No?
Are you mocking me?
No, never.
I think that Neil deGrasse Tyson is very funny, and he communicates science, and unlike me, you know, he's never just trying to be funny. He's talking science the whole time, and he's very entertaining. And I grew up reading Isaac Asimov. Asimov also, he didn't try to be a comedian, but he had a lot of personality in his writing, and he communicated a lot of information, and he did it with personality and often definitely humor.
Have any of you guys read Deborah Blum's The Poisoner's Handbook?
No.
It came out really, it's hilarious. I mean, it's all about poison, but it's really funny. You know, when there's no death. There's a lot of death, but other than that, it's really funny.
And why is it funny then?
She's got a bunch of sections where it's very personal. It's very self-deprecating about how when she was writing it, you know, her husband stopped taking coffee from her directly.
All right.
You know, because she'd be sitting there talking about cyanide and how great it was and how you couldn't detect it in anything. You know, that sort of thing.
I think Mary Roach is one of the funniest writers around, and she just happens to write about science.
She's my idol.
She's amazing, and I love every single one of her books. I'm a big dork and read a lot of science stuff and watch a lot of science shows and things like that, but not nearly as many as other people do. I've learned from some of the more pedantic emails that I get. And so, you know, my breadth of experience isn't all that great. And there are many, 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 many things that I really like. And I find funny, like Neil deGrasse Tyson's show and even Mythbusters and stuff like that. It's done with a light touch and it's all really funny and good. But Mary Roach, by an objective standard of just as a writer, she's a great writer. As a comedian, she's a great comedian. And as a science journalist, she's a great science journalist. So objectively speaking, all three of those things she combines into one. So I can't speak any more highly than that.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
Can we agree that there's the in-jokes that are designed to sort of build your community and it makes everybody feel good because we're all in on the joke. And then there's the jokes that are specifically for outreach to make the topics interesting to people that are not necessarily sciencey or critical thinkers.
I think that's true. I try pretty hard to stay away from the in-jokes because every time you include someone in your community, you exclude someone who doesn't get it.
Right.
Kind of like what Brian said earlier, I agree that I have both of those kinds of jokes, but I don't set out to do either kind. They're just the kind that come out of me. And so there's the kind that I find hysterical and I realize there's a limited audience for it. When I was mostly working comedy clubs, I would try a joke and I would think everyone's going to laugh at this. And I found, only that one guy laughed at it. Okay. So if I want to get booked back at the club, I can't do that joke all the time. But now I have the right audience that I can do those jokes. So I agree there's the two kinds, but I'm not consciously trying to include them or trying to exclude anyone or trying to do the outreach. As far as I am now trying to do outreach, but it's more just I'm going to try to communicate this information and make it understandable. I guess when I'm in that mode, I'm just not going to write an obscure joke like that because I know that I'm talking to a certain kind of audience. I'm like, how do I explain this in a way that makes sense to them?
Well, actually, we have a question from the chat on that topic from Nick Thomas, who I have to assume is Australian.
Hiya, mate. What do you do when the science in a joke goes over the audience's head?
You die a little inside.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. You go, you don't realize how funny that would be if you only...
Yeah, if you have to do that, it's done.
You got to do the Johnny Carson thing and just keep staring.
Until they learn it.
I know with blogging, you can just delete it.
Yeah, that's a thing. I have no idea what on my show goes over anyone's head. I don't hear about it. Like we were saying before, I also avoid in-jokey stuff as far as like science and skepticism as a movement and like weird celebrities who are only celebrities to this certain niche group. I avoid that. I don't consider myself part of a movement or anything because I'm a loner, Dottie, a rebel. And
hot.
But then at the same time, I have no problem inserting a joke about Shai Hulud, the holy sandworm of Arrakis, the desert planet Dune.
Oh my God.
I know. Okay.
No. You know, without even invoking a name like that, I've made a reference to sandworms. It is almost easier in a blog post or on a radio show, a podcast or radio show. But if you're on stage in front of a live audience, it's a little harsh for them to not get a joke.
Yeah. Well, and also, it's also a great feeling as an audience member. I know the stuff that I love the most is the stuff that makes me feel like I'm the only person in the world who gets it. Like, that's how I used to feel watching Mystery Science Theater years ago. There were like jokes in there that I'm like amazed that anyone would make that joke because I thought I was the one in the world. I would like, you know, I would rather 5 people really love my show than 1 million people be indifferent to it and listen. So I have no problem making jokes that might be over people's heads or might be too in-jokey. If it feels right and it feels funny to me, then maybe it will to somebody else. And maybe it'll make that one person feel very special. If you've touched one person.
Yes. I like that. And then
some people would say you're no longer a virgin.
Yeah.
That's right. Depends.
I would throw in that Futurama is one of my favorite sources of science humor. I think that that show was loaded with little in-jokes and things on signs that would go by in the background for a second that were like St. Pauli exclusion girls, like a beer that plays off St. Pauli's exclusion principle, or a 7-Eleven with a sign that says instead of ice being sold inside, it had ice 9, speaking of Vonnegut.
Actually, we have a question on that topic as well. This is from Loxloy in the chat.
I used Far Side as a classroom hook often. Ever since Gary Larson stopped publishing, I've been looking for a replacement. Suggestions?
Bizarro is a great cartoon that often has sort of animal-related. He's an animal rights activist, so sometimes there's animal stuff related. Not quite the Far Side.
I'm a big XKCD fan.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's kind of tough, though. That's not for the general audience.
That'll go over your head.
Yeah.
You know, I have to put in my own opinion here. Cracked.com and The Onion are fantastic sources of cheeky science news.
Cracked had this great one on the honey badger. Have you seen honey badgers? Those things are amazing. They're my new favorite animal.
They're the most vicious animal in the animal kingdom.
Yeah, they like, you know, this massive poison puff adder, and it like it passes out from all the poison, and it shakes it off. 2 hours later, it gets up. It's like, what? Oh, look, more puff adder. Breakfast.
They only go for the testicles.
Wow.
Yep, they'll run right up and just jump up and grab on.
You know,
well,
I don't know whether to
sort of softens it.
Yeah, I know. They sound like something you'd find in Poo Corner. Then they rip your testicles off.
Okay, so what should we be doing here? Because I find that even as someone who likes science, I like science a whole lot more when it's funny. So should we be training science teachers to do stand-up or to write lesson plan the way that Cy writes posts? Because I would take that class.
You know, I was at the AAAS conference last month, and the I gave a workshop on communicating science with humor that was sponsored by the National Science Foundation. And one thing that I made sure to say, because I've kind of encountered this before at a workshop situation, is that I wasn't trying to tell anyone to be a comedian, but it doesn't hurt to inject some humor. You can use humor. You can quote Isaac Asimov or Vonnegut or somebody. You can show Far Side cartoons. Anything that's – I wasn't trying to tell them to – to get stand-up chops, but you know, you got to engage an audience. So you have to be an engaging personality to some extent. And that's easy for most scientists, I think. I really have a high opinion of scientists and don't like the stereotypes, because I think they're amazing people that are more childlike and have maintained their childlike wonder with the universe.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to be funny all the time.
Right.
I'm funny only on Fridays.
To be someone who people find interesting and listen to, I think the most important thing you can do in outside of science, in any walk of life, in anything you do, is just be genuine. If people mm-hmm. trust you and trust that you're being a genuine person and aren't trying to pull something over or talk down to them or talk over them, you're just being who you are, people pick up on that, whether you're funny or not. And I know there are a lot of science communicators that are very good at it. I've seen a few that aren't, but I mean, I'm not sure how much you could train and what you couldn't train. But if you feel like it's a struggle to communicate, then I think maybe you're doing it in the wrong way.
I think that's a great point, is that you should be yourself, and that not try to be somebody else. And most people are funnier than they realize, probably. And that, you know, be true to the material and be true to yourself. I agree.
And there's also the fact that, you know, if you are interested and if you are passionate mm-hmm. about the material, you will communicate it well. You could be talking about honey badgers. You could be talking about penises. You could be talking about cancer. But if you're into it and you're interested, then they will be too.
Oh, on that note, thank you very much for being here, guys. That was great.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks so much.
There are links to Brian Mallow, Brian Thompson, and Cy Curious on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. Since you're there, click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the podcast, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking. Last week, Skeptically Speaking celebrated its second anniversary of being on the air, trying to make science accessible in our own way. We received many lovely congratulations from fans, friends, and former guests of the show, including one special message from someone that we're happy to count as all three. Kylie Sturgis, author of the blog Pod Black Cat and host of the Token Skeptic podcast, created this tribute that was too funny not to share. Thanks, Kylie, and thank you for listening. Enjoy!
Welcome to Julia Child's Home to Comic-Con podcast. It's a show that puts the Satan back into Santa and helps with handy tips to get those nasty bloodstains out of your sacrificial carpets. But first, a few words from our sponsors. The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, the Weather Underground, the Red Brigades, Black September, the Party for Democratic Ampuchia, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Columbia, PLO, KGB, Shining Path, Al-Qaeda, or Desiree Shell's handbag manufacturer.
Hi, I'm Leeching Robin, and this is yet another gripping episode of Lifestyles of the Not Quite Parsec Award-winning Podcasters. Today we'll be looking at the scurrilous and scandalous lifestyle of the host of Skeptically Speaking podcast, Desiree Shell.
Oh my.
Humble Canadian radio celebrity or radical ringleader of feminist progressives?
To tell you the truth, Canada has fairly reasonable laws in terms of stuff like that.
We investigate her humble beginnings, especially the wild and extremist world of community radio.
There's a lot of people with a lot to say, and a severe aversion to saying it publicly.
We raise questions as to whether she's an icon of outreach efforts, or feminist and disciplinarian interrogator of terrified nerds everywhere.
I'm a pedal, really.
What could be her ulterior and reformist aims hidden behind that Canadian accent?
Experts in scientific fields and just, you know, random geekery. Potentially very embarrassing questions being asked.
We even feature exclusive insights into her plans for domination of the American airwaves.
People confuse Canadians with Americans a lot.
Especially her famous secret weapon that she has in store.
Mm-hmm, Donald Southern.
Yes, that one.
Good call.
All this and radically more on the next episode of Lifestyles of the Not Quite Parsec Award-winning Podcasters. Desiree Shell, the woman, the militant feminism, Donald Sutherland, And how come you're not really fancying his son? I mean, you know, 24 wasn't that bad.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically, that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.